Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Molly.
I just realized I don't really have to say welcome, everyone, because it's just us. So hello to you. And I'm really grateful for this do-over opportunity. We had such a nice conversation the other day on the Wholeness Hangout. And for people who are listening for the first time and don't already know you, I want to say something about why I want to do this with you. The immediate pretext, of course, is you have a new book out, The Little Book of Results, which is terrific, and I highly recommend it to folks. But the deeper reason, because I don't generally just have people on to pimp their books, the deeper reason is that I've been following you for maybe 4 or 5 years, and in listening to and watching some of your work, training coaches and workshops, I was struck by your commitment to the person in front of you. There's a care and commitment to that being that I saw even in your very earliest work. And I say even because sometimes that looks to me like something that comes later in people's experience in the inside-out understanding or what you call the principles of clarity or results. And I was really touched by that. And that, more than the content of what you do, gave you credibility for me. That made you somebody to pay attention to. And then when Clarity came out, I thought, well, this is really interesting, because the strength I saw in Clarity was the ability to point to the principles behind how the mind works, behind how human beings experience their lives, and how understanding that can help us be happier, more effective, more whatever. And you brought in a strain of, for lack of a better word, I'll say model making. You're able to weave together ancient and contemporary thought about what it means to be human, what it means to be successful, and some conventional kind of model-y ideas about success and effectiveness, but firmly rooted in these psycho-spiritual principles that we have in common in our work. And that's a more long-winded explanation than I wanted to give, but I think what I said the other day was, I also follow you on Twitter, and I love seeing who you follow and what you're reading. It looks to me like you like to geek out on the kind of stuff I like to geek out on. But in geeking out over meaning-making and sense-making and philosophy and science, you always connect it to or find the common thread with these fundamental principles. And I often find that people are either on the geek outside or the principle side, and it's fun to find somebody who likes to play with the interconnections. So that's my story of why you're here.
Well, and it's really cool to hear that, Molly, because a couple of things I heard in what you said. First of all, right back at when you started your kind introduction, the thing you said about caring, it looks to me like that's fundamental to everything I do. Like that looks to me like where the kind of where the power is, like that care and love, that is what's behind all the work. And when someone as a coach is being effective, that's one of the things that's the power source behind that. So that looks absolutely fundamental to me. But the thing you were saying about models and geeking out, since long before I understood anything about the principles, I used to be a computer operator and a computer programmer back in the 1980s. So early days, 80s, 90s, then I got into project management. But when I was a computer programmer, there was this really interesting thing, which was frustrating to my bosses often. But I, before I could do much of anything, I had to really understand what was going on. So I'd be asking lots of questions, and I'd have to get much further under the hood than many of my contemporaries, doing stuff that seemed irrelevant, just trying to add it up in my head before I could move forward. But then once I understood it, I could really make progress. And so I found over the years, it was the same when I was exploring NLP and hypnosis. It was the same when I first started learning the principles. It was like, until I understand it, I can't, and until it makes sense to me, like real sense, mm-hmm. I can't really say anything about it to anyone else. So there's a certain, I use the phrase geeking out. Yeah. Like I kind of have to geek out and find answers to my questions and make sure, like, I can't just take it on faith. I can't just say, oh, well, you know, so-and-so says it's like this. So it's got to hang together for me. And so that's really had me go on a journey of, you know, I hear these things, like everyone has innate well-being. I'm like, really? Let's find out about that. Someone's saying, you know, resilience is, you know, everyone's born with it. Really? Let's find out about that. So I've, you know, there's a way in which my journey so far with these principles has been one of looking for exceptions and seeing if I can prove it wrong and trying to find out how does this thing hang together. And in the first instance, that's just for my own kind of satisfaction or kind of so I have credibility with myself around that. So that was the second thing that came up, that just this journey to understand is, that's a meaningful one to me. And then the third thing that kind of when you were saying about model making and stuff, and combining the old and the new, I don't know if you know the story, but back in the late 90s, I was given a copy of Sydney Banks's book, The Missing Link.
Right.
And I read quickly through it. Like my habit is to polarity respond. I go to the opposite of what people say. So there was, I think someone had written in the preface to it or something like that, said, no one will be able to read this book and not be impacted. I was like, we'll see about that.
This one can.
but I kind of dismissed that book. Now that book is now one of my favorite books, but at the time it just didn't land with me. And you could say, well, maybe I just wasn't ready for it. And that's quite possible. But when I wrote Clarity, part of my purpose in writing it was to answer the question, what's the book I wish someone had handed me back in 1999 that I would have been able to hear? So one of my kind of guiding lights for teaching and sharing this understanding and for writing and for everything I do is, how can I make it easy for people to look in the direction I'm pointing? Mm. How can I make it easy for them? Instead of putting up barriers to them looking in this direction, how can I make it easy for them to look in this direction? And so that's what I endeavor to do with Clarity, and that's what I endeavor to do with Results, and that's what I've endeavored to do with my latest book, The Little Book of Results, is to make it as easy and as practical as possible for people to look in the direction I'm pointing. Because my take on it, Molly, is if these be principles, if this really is what's behind high performance and well-being and love and connection and all of this, then it's got to be practical. It's got to be, you know, as useful for a firefighter running into a burning building or a hockey player being put on the ice in the closing minutes of the game. It's got to be as relevant there as it is for someone meditating in a temple or watching a sunset.
Mm-hmm.
It's right across the board. It's universal.
Right. So I tend to read things from that point of view too. A little bit of a contrarian. And I even this book.
Yeah, right. I can see what's coming.
Yeah. So one of the first stakes you put in the ground is that human beings are built for reality, optimized for results, evolved to survive, transform, and thrive. And as I read that, I thought, okay, big boy.
Okay, Buster.
Yeah. What is reality?
Yeah, what even is reality?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you what I mean by that statement and how I think of reality in the context of the statement that we're built for reality and optimized for results. And I've got several lenses on it, you could say. And the first lens is an evolutionary one, like the fact that we're even able to have this conversation or that anyone's able to listen to it is a function of the fact that we've evolved from hundreds of thousands of generations of people or beings, let's say, because this doesn't just start from when we were humans. It goes all the way back through our evolutionary ancestry. The fact that we're even alive means we come from a long line of people who managed to survive until breeding age, attract a mate, have sex at least once, and give rise to a progeny who then went on to do the same thing. And that's happened over and over again, hundreds of thousands of times, over hundreds of thousands of years. And to me, it's kind of obvious and simultaneously shocking to me, if I think about it, that all 7 billion of us on this planet have come from this long and unbroken line of ancestry. It's like, wow, isn't that amazing? And what that means is we've been involved in the longest product development life cycle in history, you know, and we are the leading edge of that. And we've evolved for life on this planet. So we are quite literally built, adapted, evolved for the reality of life on an earth and in a universe that works exactly and precisely the way that this universe does. You know, that this is the world we're built for. We're not built to, you know, we haven't evolved for Mars. Someone else might have, but we've evolved for life on Earth. That's where we've evolved for. So that's my first meaning of built for reality, is the evolutionary frame. But there's a second way in which we're built for reality, which is the reality, the world that we've evolved for. For instance, the world we've evolved for, the Earth we've evolved for, has always been an Earth that went around the sun. Like, that's the way it has always worked. And so for much of human history, we believed that it worked some other way. But actually, the world we've evolved for is one where the Earth goes around the sun. Same with something like the cause of infection, which we now know to be bacteria. It's germs. We lived in a world where there were germs for millennia, but we didn't know about the reality of that until very, very recently, like just the last 150 years max. We just didn't know about it. So the reality we're built for has always been the reality of germs and bacteria, but we didn't know about it. And so there's huge survival value in understanding how reality actually works. Like, there's, you know, the discovery of, or the formalization of germ theory, as well as the improvements in hygiene, like through modern sewage systems and that sort of thing, has added an average of 30 years to the average human lifespan. That's amazing. Just through discovering something that was already true about reality. And so the reason so those are the first two lenses, if you like, of what I mean by you're built for reality. But here's the kicker. We can believe anything we like. We can think anything we like. And we live in, it was interesting, we live in a world where many, many people have, you know, quite a low opinion of what they're capable of and how fragile they are and all this sort of stuff, that we can think those things and believe them to be true. But in fact, because we're built for reality, we have this innate resilience, this clarity, this incredible capacity to learn, this capacity for creativity and all of that. And when we believe that the world works in a way that it does not, that gets in our way. And when we wake up to the fact of how the world works, that helps us out. So I'll land the plane now with the principles. We have the power to believe that we're feeling something other than thought. But the world we live in is one where we're always living in the feeling of thought, where we're living in the feeling of our psychology, where we're living in the feeling of the goggles we're wearing, is the way I put it in the book. Well, we can believe we live in a world where we're feeling something other than that, just like we can believe we live in a world where, you know, men from the government are controlling my thoughts with a laser beam, but that doesn't make it so. And when we're aligned with reality, when we're awake to the truth of how our minds work and how reality works, that helps us out. That does good things for us.
So let me see if I can... how to ask this. And I guess I'm wondering if this is the right place for people who may be new to what we're talking about to ask this question. But so I'll build it up. Where I'm going is, if thought and feeling aren't telling us about the world out here, or even about, you know, how Molly's doing, how Jamie's doing, if they're not telling us that reliably, how do we ever align with reality?
Well, what a great question. And it looks to me like our feelings are perfectly reliable. They are incredibly reliable. They are so precise and accurate that we can rely on them 100% to tell them about what, to tell us about what they're telling us about. So the way I see it anyway, Molly, is our feelings. So just to backtrack a little bit, a bit of the way that our perceptual systems work is it seems to us, it genuinely seems to us as though we're looking out through our eyes at a world out there. Like we're looking out through little windows in our heads, out of the world out there. But that's not actually how our perceptions work. Our brains are contained in a sealed, darkened container called our skulls. There are no windows in the skull. It's a sealed room, you could say. But there are data feeds into the brain from our senses. And then based on that data, our minds go, what must be out there? What's my best guess at what's out there? And we create a perceptual reality. Now, by a perceptual reality, I'm not suggesting that I'm creating this phone that I'm holding in my hand or this bag that I'm holding in my hand. I'm sure they exist, but 100% of my perception of them is being created from within my mind. Moment to moment, every second of the day, every second of your life, that is happening. And that's extraordinary. Like the incredible feat of creating a perceptual reality that's fit for purpose enough for us to navigate the world, that's an extraordinary accomplishment. It's absolutely amazing. And it looks so much like if it's working well, it maps so well onto whatever's out there, quote unquote, that it doesn't even occur to us that we're actually walking around in a thought-generated perceptual reality. It doesn't occur to me that often, and I teach this stuff for a living, right? So our feelings are always telling us about that process of creation, that momentary creation of a perceptual reality. Our feelings are telling us about the kind of perceptual reality that we're creating in this moment. So if I'm feeling connected to someone, that feeling is letting me know that I'm in a connected perceptual reality. If I am feeling frustrated as I, you know, try and put together a piece of furniture, that feeling is letting me know I'm wearing frustration goggles. I'm creating a frustrated perceptual reality, or I'm occupying a frustrated perceptual reality. If I'm feeling sad, that's just letting me know I'm wearing sad goggles. If I'm feeling happy, that's letting me know I'm wearing happy goggles. So our feelings, it looks to me anyway, Molly, looks to me like our feelings are 100% accurate, 100% trustworthy, and 100% reliable. They will give us precision feedback about the kind of perceptual reality we're generating in that moment. So that's not an issue or a problem. That's actually a really good thing. That's super, super valuable. The issue is we have a completely natural tendency to assign our feelings to the contents of our perceptual reality. So my feelings are telling me about the goggles I'm wearing, but I look through those goggles and I see a horse or a car or a piece of work or a talk, and I believe the feelings are telling me about the thing I'm looking at rather than where I'm looking from. Our feelings are always telling us about where we're looking from, but we have the tendency to attribute them to what we're looking at.
And how does understanding that? I'm still kind of grappling with this. Experientially, I know that this helps me align with reality. At least that's my story. But I'm wondering, so what is the... What does knowing what I'm looking from do for me such that I'm in better alignment with what I'm looking or think I'm looking at? Does that question make sense?
Yeah. So here's how it looks to me, Molly. When we know that our feelings are giving us information about the goggles we're wearing, the perceptual goggles we're wearing, and not what we're looking at, it does two things in my experience. The first thing is it, and when I say no, when we understand, when we know it in an embodied sense, when we know it insightfully, like in the moment, like I'm telling you this stuff, right? But 5 minutes from now, I could get frustrated about something and not realize that I'm feeling the goggles. The trick of the mind that has us attribute our feelings to the content of what we're experiencing rather than the process of experiencing itself, I am as subject to that trick of the mind as anyone else. But how it helps is in two ways. Number one, when you insightfully realize that you're feeling that perceptual process and not what you're looking at, it instantly removes the sense of being a victim of a world out there with power over how you feel. It seems to me, you know, there's this beautiful poem by Hafiz, and there's a line in it. He says, your separation from God, from love, is the hardest work in this world. And it looks to me like we're never separate from life. We're never separate from love, from God, from the oneness of being. But we have the ability to believe we are. We have the ability to believe that we're separate when we go outside in, when we believe we're feeling something other than thought. And the moment we believe that, then we've got a to-do list of, you know, as soon as I believe I'm at the mercy of something out there in the future, or out there in the past, or out there in other people, then it becomes very, very important to get it, or it seems very important to get control over whatever that thing is, or to protect myself from it, or whatever. And so that creates an overhead, that creates a whole bunch of wear and tear. So the first thing it does, the first thing knowing this does, like knowing it insightfully in the moment does, is it heals that separation. So that's what it can do for someone real time in the moment, is bring you home to who you really are. So that's the first thing, and in a way, that's everything. But the cool thing is, once that's happened a few times, as you start to kind of notice that happening, that it makes, in my experience, makes you less like, I don't know if I want to say less likely to get tricked, because I don't see many less likely to get tricked, but somehow less concerned when you do get tricked or something. It's kind of hard to put the words on it, but it's like you start to get a feel for it. Like you, it makes you, perhaps more suspicious of when you do go outside in about something.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm just want to run this by you and see if this makes sense. It's occurring to me, it's sort of like we human beings are built for reality. We have the misperception or misunderstanding that being built for reality requires a cognitive engagement with the world, and that our perceptual feed is giving us reliable data for that. The data stream is related to how we're built for reality. It's related to our interface with reality.
Yep.
But our thinking about that data stream is not generally as helpful as we suspect.
Yeah.
It's like the phenomena of the data stream and our responses to that when we don't have a lot of additional thinking, or when we're aware of our goggles, we're more likely to allow our whole beings to calibrate and recalibrate and try and recalibrate and experiment. So there's an adjustment, adaptation, engagement going on that is independent of our mental processes.
Yeah, and the other piece I'd add into that, which is, I think this will be like, oh yeah, of course, when I say it. There's a huge cognitive overhead of believing something that isn't true. Like believing something that isn't true in relation to your day-to-day activities, behavior, cognition. Believing something that isn't true throws a throws an overhead into the system, and it's totally natural. Anytime we don't understand how an aspect of life works, we tend to make up more complex models to try and explain it.
Yeah.
Like just by definition, when we don't know what causes something, will tend to confuse correlation with causation and make up excessively complicated models to deal with.
Thunder gods.
Yeah, right? So there's the any time you get closer to reality, it has a simplifying process, effect. It simplifies things. And so it gives you less on your mind. So here's an example. I've been coaching people one way or another for 20 years. But over the last 10 years, my coaching has become so much simpler because people don't look, the challenges people have and the struggles they have and the impediments to achieving their goals and how to clear that up and that sort of thing just looks a lot simpler to me. And so that process of simplification is a result of getting a better understanding of how the mind works, getting closer to reality. And so I think that's true. You know, if we think of anything we do, whether it's learning a musical instrument or learning to drive a car, once you know how to do it, once you understand how the system works, it's always simpler than it was before you understand it. It just looks baffling. It's like, geez, how is that even possible? Once you understand it, it's much simpler.
Yeah. You know, driving a car is an example that really works for me because I'm a person who did not have any driving experience before I showed up at 14 in Driver's Head. And turning left, or right for that matter, but left was the most complicated. Turn signal, oncoming traffic, possible side traffic, slowing down, maybe a clutch involved, rear view mirror. I mean, holy crap, there's a lot of stuff to pay attention to. And it was just puzzling. And then going straight was no piece of cake. Because in a car, where is the center line relative to your car? It's not right in front of you. And I remember puzzling over how to find the center line. And I'm weird, maybe. actually trying to cognitively suss out how to orient myself so that the car would be in the right lane and the right distance from the center line and the side. And I remember the moment I realized that even though I might be able to successfully figure it out for one car in one circumstance, that was taking too many reasons. It wasn't helping me. But I, in the same moment, I got a sense that there was some ability, capacity to orient that I was overlooking or that was beginning to kick in. I'm not sure how to accurately name it. And I started to not worry about the edges of the car and the center line, but to allow myself, my whole being, to be educated by the circumstances. And now I notice every once in a while I'll go out and I'll realize I'm a jumpy driver. And I don't know what's going on. I'm anxious or there's something happening. And when I feel that way, I notice that I start getting preoccupied by where stuff's coming from and where am I. And I have discovered through experience how not helpful that is. And it seems to me that that's an analog for the many times in our lives where we try to do that cognitive overhead using the wrong capacities, the wrong abilities to orient ourselves and engage in space and time.
And the thing I really like about that example as well is my sense listening to you, Molly, is you now know that when you have that kind of jumpy feeling, that's not telling you about the traffic conditions.
Yeah.
That's worth knowing. Like,
that is really helpful. Yeah.
Because what I find, and in a way, that's the perfect analog for this thing, is that for most people, a lot of the time, and any sensation like that will seem like it must have something to do with the traffic. You know, it's like, well, no smoke without fire. There must be something going on with the traffic or my car or something to have me feeling like this. But part of the gift of what we've been talking about is to discover when it comes to our feelings, there's often smoke without fire. Like the feelings are there to let us know about the goggles we're wearing. And if I've slipped on a pair of jumpy goggles, it's worth me knowing that. Otherwise I might think I've fallen into a jumpy reality. And it's just like if I'm walking down the street and I start feeling nervous about, what's going on around here, that sort of thing, there might be something going on. There might be, but knowing that my feelings are letting me know about the goggles I'm wearing clears up one of the possible sources of confusion.
Yeah. You know, this, I'm cognizant that people watching or listening might wonder what the heck this has to do with results. And I think we're getting close. Because if we go down the street believing our jumpy feeling is telling us about the circumstances, or I believe my jumpy feeling driving is telling me about exterior circumstances, I start to overreact, overrespond, or underrespond. Mm-hmm. I engage ineffectively with mm-hmm. reality. You have a little model in your book that I think you call the Clarity Productivity Quadrant. Mm-hmm. And in it, one of the things you label is contaminated thinking. And I think it might be useful for us to talk about that quadrant. And before going there, I thought, what is contaminated thinking?
Yeah, great question. So contaminated thinking is just a name I gave to thinking that's generated by the outside in illusion. So anytime we believe we're feeling something other than thought, that's what I'm labeling contaminated thinking. So another name I give to that is anytime we're in la-la land. Like la-la land is when we're believing we live in a world that works outside in. Like the implications of the inside-out understanding is that we're always living in the feeling of thought. We're never feeling anything other than thought. And as you see that for yourself, that'll do something for you. Well, in terms of what does this have to do with results in general, my starting assertion is that, hey, we're built for reality. And whatever you may think about yourself, you're a results creator. You're born to be able to do stuff, to make things happen, to create things. And often, I'll give you an example, Molly. I was coaching someone at a conference a year or two ago, doing a coaching demo. And this was someone who wanted to start a coaching business. And so she'd been working on her practice and making plans and that sort of thing. And she said, oh, I'm trying to be positive, but sometimes I get scared that it's not going to work. And I go to her, I go, oh, well, that could happen. Like, and I said, I know I'm going to sound like a terrible coach. That could happen. It could not work. Like that happens to businesses and practices every year. That happens, but that's okay. That's worth knowing. You don't, you know, pretending that can't happen isn't going to help you with that. I said to her, but I don't think the issue is that it might not work out. I think your issue is that you've been believing that if it didn't work out, you wouldn't be able to handle it. And she kind of relaxed. She said, yeah. For a bunch of reasons, including her fears about how messed up she'd be if it failed, how ashamed she'd be, how she wouldn't be able to, all the people she'd been telling about what she was doing, how she'd have to be going back with her tail between her legs. And how it might crush her dreams and she wouldn't be able to cope with that. And I was just like you're capable of way, way more than you think. And you can handle way, way more than you think. You're way more resilient than you think. And if you believe that you are so fragile that you wouldn't even be able to handle the thing you're working on not working out, well, that's going to have you be way too timid and way too precious and way too perfectionistic, and all the things that stop people from creating results are caused by them. Well, not all of them, but so many of the things that stop people even getting out of the starting gates, even like and going, are this belief that they couldn't handle it if it didn't work out, or it couldn't handle it if they failed, or I couldn't handle it if someone criticized me. And it's like, man, you can handle that stuff. You can handle it. Now go get amongst it, have at it, go for it. So a big part of what this, you know, Sid Banks once said, if the one thing people learned was not to be afraid of their experience, that alone would change the world. Well, that looks true to me, that like people's fear about
how it would work out, or what if I can't do it, or what if I'm not enough, or all that sort of stuff. That's what stops people creating results. Like, we're born results creators. Like, everyone watching and listening to this has done things like learn to walk, learn to talk, learn to, you know, ride a bike and do incredible things. But that's built on a framework of being willing to try stuff out and not overthinking it and all that sort of stuff. So to me, the essence of this is subtractive. It's about taking away the things that get in the way of us creating the results that we're actually set up to create. Like, we're actually one. You look at a class of kindergarten kids, they're creating results like crazy. They're, you know, doing all kinds of cool stuff because they haven't yet learned to be afraid of it, you know.
Yeah, and they have meltdowns and they get over them.
Yeah, exactly. They and it's not that they don't go outside in, they totally do. But they haven't yet built a game plan for life that has them thinking, believing something that is fundamentally untrue about how the world works.
Yeah.
So that, in a nutshell, that's what it has to do with creating results. And it also ties into the productivity quadrant. You know, the productivity quadrant, it basically, a lot of times, so it's got four zones. It's a classic consulting quadrant. So we've got the zone of resistance, which I'm sure a lot of people can identify with, which is rumination, distraction, overanalysis. When people talk about feeling stuck, they're often hanging out in the zone of resistance. And that's typically typified by what I would call a passive stance and contaminated thinking. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing that people are very aware of is what I call the zone of inspired action, which is when you're just feeling it and you can't put a foot wrong and it all flows. And everyone seems to think that the key to, if you're stuck in the zone of resistance, the key is to get inspired. I'll wait till I'm inspired. But actually, there are two other zones that are really useful to know about. One is the zone of reflection, which is just it's still a passive mode, but it's not characterized by contaminated thinking. So just being in a reflective space. So meditation, a state of meditation is an example of the zone of reflection. So it's being clear-headed, but you're not really doing anything. You're mm-hmm. just hanging out. So that one of the ways to find your way into productivity is by hitting the zone of reflection. That can be useful. But the other way, and this is kind of counterintuitive, and this is actually my favorite way of getting productive, is the zone of uninspired action. She's just like, okay, well, I'm not feeling it. I'm going to take action anyway. I'm not going to wait until I am inspired. I'm not going to wait until I am feeling the flow or anything like that. I'm just going to start anyway. I'm just going to start doing stuff and see what happens. And often getting moving in the zone of uninspired action is like walking through molasses. Like, it's hard going. Yeah. However, the thing that amazes me again and again and again is if you're willing to go there, how quickly you find yourself in the zone of inspired action.
Yeah.
But my experience is the move is almost never from resistance to inspired action. It's always via one of the other two zones. And yet almost everyone I speak to who's stuck in resistance is waiting for inspired lightning to strike. And it just, that seems like a long wait to me. Like and I remember, Molly, I was once talking to a client about this, and she said, and I bet people will be able to relate to this. She said, you know, so she was working on a book. She said, I got so inspired about this book and I worked all weekend on it and I was really feeling it. And then I woke up Monday morning and I didn't feel inspired at all. And so I thought, well, maybe it's not the right thing to be working on. Mm. I said, why would how you feel have anything to do with whether it's the right thing or not. She said, well, I thought if it's the right thing for me to be working on, I would feel inspired every time I thought about it, every time I went to work on it. I'm like, that's not my experience about anything. Like,
not even pizza.
Not even pizza. Well, I maintain high levels of inspiration with relation to pizza by not allowing myself to have any. But the thing that hit me in that moment, we're in England at the time. I said, look, the weather in England is notoriously changeable. I said, if you were to say the only time you could work on your book was when it's sunny out, would that be a good move? And she goes, no. I said, why not? She goes, well, I don't want to make working on doing what I want to work on, I don't want to make that dependent on the weather. I said, well, why would you make it dependent on the weather of your thinking? Like, your feelings are just letting you know about the mood you're in. Why would you want to make your productivity dependent on your mood when your mood is totally changeable? Like, it's just going to be whatever thought-generated perceptual reality is blowing through in the moment. Why would you want to make your productivity and your work and the stuff that matters most to you, why would you want to make that dependent on your perceptual weather? And she just hadn't seen it like that. She had thought there's some special relationship between how she felt and the work she was thinking about. And I said, look, you know, your feelings don't even know there's such a thing as books. Mm-hmm. Your feelings have no idea about your activities over the next week. They're just letting you know about the goggles you're wearing.
You know, there's something here that I'd like to highlight for folks. And that's that is the role of insight into understanding what we've been referring to as the principles, the three principles, the principles behind clarity. How do you move from one quadrant to another? Is how you move from one quadrant to another, or that you move, is a function, it seems to me, of insight. When we see insightfully that what keeps us in the difference between resistance and uninspired action is that in resistance, we think our feelings are telling us something about our relationship to what's possible, or our abilities, or the opportunities, or the future. When we understand that that's just isn't necessarily so, uninspired action becomes a meaningful choice, not a suck it up and do it. I mean, you may decide to suck it up and do it, but you do it because it looks like a valid option.
Yeah. And at the most basic level, because the models, all the models in the book, they're just descriptive. They're not saying what people should do. The only, if I was being hardcore about it, the only difference between the zone of resistance and the zone of uninspired action is in the zone of uninspired action, the person's doing something.
Yeah.
That's like the thing you asked about, what's the value of knowing this? I loved what you said about it, seeing it insightfully makes uninspired action a valid choice. And knowing, one again, it's another thing where once you've been through it a few times, once you're kind of seeing, oh, that is a thing, it the validity of the choice means you can just go, oh, I know how this works, suck it up. And it's so there's a, my sense almost is that once you see that that is an option, it is an option to, you know, to just do it, that's a sign that already you're seeing things more clearly. So yeah. I don't know, it sounds a bit spacey, but there's something about as you start to see for yourself that this is how it works. It's almost like when I don't want to do something and I'm thinking about it, I'm like, oh man, I really don't want to do it. I know that the water's not that cold. It looks like it's a freezing cold lake I'm just about to jump into, but having done it enough times, I know the water's not that cold. Yeah. So I can just go, okay, great, crack on with it. And so it's a learning process as well, you know, learning about the tricks of the mind and learning to see through them. So yeah, it is a valid choice. And I keep wanting to add something, but actually it's about what's taken away, isn't it?
Yeah. And actually maybe that's a place to, it's just a tiny little chunk that we could maybe cover in 5 minutes and then I can let you go. And that's subtractive psychology and VUCA. How hard would that be?
Okay. So VUCA is a term coined by the U.S. Army War College, actually, in the 90s, which stands for volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. And it was coined in relation to just the changing nature of the military engagements that the U.S. Army were involved in. But it's been co-opted by a lot of technologists and business people and thinkers to describe actually, you know, the effect of exponential technology, you know, that we have in our phones and our artificial intelligence and everything, the effect of that is creating a world that is far more volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And my guess is probably everyone watching and listening to this can relate to that. You know, we all, it would be pretty hard not to have seen the increase in volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity, whether it's in your own social media feed or whether it's in recent elections around the world or whether it's in the way that, you know, different things are taking off very quickly, the changes in what's possible. I mean, we're right at the beginning of the information revolution. It's all set to become weirder. So VUCA is that term to just a point to these effects that have been noticed. It was very interesting. I was reading about the work done by the Institute for the Future, and their view is that insight, so VUCA plus insight, creates what they call positive VUCA, which is volatility resolves to vision, having a vision for how the world could be. Uncertainty resolves to understanding, having an understanding about the forces that are playing out. Complexity resolves to clarity about the way forward, clarity about what matters, all that sort of stuff. And ambiguity resolves to agility. So they talk about going from negative VUCA to positive VUCA. And it looks to me, Molly, like there's a way in which the instinctive or the protective response to volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity is to kind of hunker down and go, okay, well, I'll just wait till things kind of calm down a bit. But in a world that's increasingly VUCA, that move doesn't work. So we need to look in the direction of insight, look in the direction of realization, and kind of embrace the complexity of the world we're living in and embrace our ability to learn and to grow and all of that in the face of it. So it looks to me like when people are faced with that complexity, they have a tendency to look for additive approaches. And the structure of an additive approach is available on the cover of every magazine in the bookstore. Like Men's Health, it'll be the seven the seven keys to six-pack abs, or the five foods you need to eliminate to have bulging biceps, or, you know, 6 points to make you have amazing hair, whatever it might be. On all the women's magazines, it's everything from, you know, we've seen all the, every month, a different seven tips or that sort of thing. And those lists of additive ideas, the ideas like you plus the top tips equals super you. And that's
and in
very,
leadership, you plus these five leadership skills.
Right. And it's very compelling to the mind, but actually what we find is that understanding is subtractive. It's about, like, no one needs, if what you've got is too much complexity, too much to think about, no one needs another seven things to think about, and what always does the heavy lifting is insight and realization. So the term subtractive psychology is one that I coined to point to the subtractive nature of understanding how the mind works and how your life works. The whole idea of this, but even more importantly, the impact of it, is to take things off your mind, to give you less to think about. And it's kind of interesting, Molly, that was never a concept or that was never a thing that I had a filing cabinet space for in my mind. The idea that you could learn something that takes things off your mind was like, it never occurred to me that that might be a thing, that you could learn something for yourself that will clear your head, that will give you less to think about, that will simplify your life. I never knew that was possible, but as I grew to understand these principles, I saw that is what it's doing. It's a subtractive approach. Now, the interesting thing is, additive approaches are very compelling. Like, we like them. They appeal to our conscious mind. But subtraction is what's effective. Mm-hmm. And understanding is always subtracting.
And this is huge for coaching.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can coach from a platform of what do we add, what do we acquire, what do we learn in a technical sense and a cognitive sense, even an emotional sense, that adds to our ability to respond, when really what... If we're built for reality and designed to adapt and learn in an organic and related way with reality, minus the burden of our psychological overhead, then having less on our mind has got to make us more, better equipped to create results and to respond to whatever actually comes up in the world.
Yeah, and you know, another way of framing that would be just having less superstitions is generally going to be a good thing. Like if we took two people and one of them has 500, like in the course of their daily life, there are 500 things that they're superstitious of, and the person standing next to them only has five things they're superstitious of. The person who's got 500 things they're superstitious of, just to go to the shops and back, they're going to be weaving round ladders and dodging black cats and jumping over cracks in the pavement. And they got like 500 superfluous activities to engage in to get safely to the shops and back. With the person who's only got five, they're going to be spending less of their energy on stuff that is nonsense.
Wow.
And I speak as someone who spends a whole bunch of my, like, I know each, I don't like to think of myself as the kind of guy who goes around believing stuff that's not real. And I am that kind of guy, and we all are. And when we can look that square in the face and go, okay, I am subject to, I'm vulnerable to getting tricked by my own perception. Just knowing that, that right there, you know, there's that wonderful Richard Feynman quote. He said, the first principle is not to fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool. Just knowing that, it's like, okay, I am susceptible to fooling myself. That's useful to know. Like that right there will clear superstitions away. So that, to me, that's helpful.
Great. Well, Jamie, I could do this all day, and I really appreciate you giving me an opportunity and everyone who gets to watch and listen an opportunity to get a glimpse of your book. It's a little book of results, but what'd you say? It's 300 and some pages?
I would never say something like that. I can't imagine that it's that many pages.
But they're short pages. And spacious pages.
The little book of results is only 2/3 the size of the original book results. So it's definitely distilled and condensed.
Yeah. It's very valuable. I encourage folks to check it out. And Jamie, if people want to find you beyond the book, where should they go?
JamieSmart.com is my website, JamieSmart.com, or I mean all the usual social places, just go to JamieSmart.com. So on Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, all that stuff, JamieSmart.com.
Great. Is there anything else you'd like to say that we haven't touched on or to button this up?
Well, it's the one thing I'd say to everyone is, you're capable of more than you think because you are more than you think. Even if you're taking that into account, you're still more than that. And you know, that right there can be kind of shocking to get a glimpse of as well, that all your ideas about yourself, you're more than that. You're more than that. And again, kind of back to where we started, that sense of we've evolved through hundreds of thousands of generations of people. We have this unbroken line back to the dawn of civilization and before that. That's extraordinary to me. You know, people are amazing. And that includes, despite the ideas they may have about why they're not enough or all that sort of stuff, you're so much more than what you think.
That's great. Wonderful. Jamie, thank you a million. And folks, do get the book and check out the additional Wholeness Hangouts. There's a link on the bottom of this page to those. And thanks for listening or watching.